3. Sometime after midnight on the 21st of December, it began to snow. By morning, in the gray spectral light of a brief and obscure winter sun, the fields lay dead white and touched with a phosphorus glow as if producing illumination of themselves. And the snow was still wisping down thickly, veiling the trees beyond the creek and the mountain itself, falling softly and softly, faintly sounding in the immense white silence. On that morning, the old man rose early and stared long out at the little valley. Nothing moved. The snow fell ceaselessly. When he pushed the screen door, it dragged heavily in the drifts packed on the porch and against the house. He stood there in his shirt sleeves, watching the great wafers of snow list and slide, dodging the posts at the corner of the house. It was very cold. The hiss of the coffee pot boiling over on the stove brought him in again. All day it darkened so that when night came, no one could tell just when it had come about. Yet the snow fell undiminished. Windless, pillowed in silence, downsifting. No one was about. All the dogs were quiet. In his house, the old man lit a lamp and settled back in a stout rocker near the stove. He selected a magazine from a rack alongside, an ancient issue of Field and Stream, limp and worn, the pages soft as chamois, spread it on his lap and began to leaf through it, who knew it now almost by heart. Stories, pictures, advertisements. From time to time he could hear scuffling sounds beneath him, scratchings in the darkness under the floor where Scout turned uneasily in his nest of rotting sacks. He turned the pages for a while and then got up and went to the kitchen where, from a high cupboard above the tapless sink, he fetched down a molasses jar near filled with a viscous brick-colored liquid opaque as clay. He screwed off the cap, took a clean jelly jar from the sideboard and poured it full. Then he went back to his chair, settled the drink on its broad arm, adjusted the magazine in his lap, and began to rock gently back and forth, the liquid in the glass lapping sluggishly with the motion. Now and again he took a sip, staining the white stubble beneath his lip a deep maroon. The oil lamp glowed serenely at its image, a soft corolla, inflaming the black window glass where a curled and withered spider dangled from a dusty thread. The old man rocked, dwarf-like, in his ponderous chair. He seemed to be weighing some dark problem posed in the yellowed pages before him. Toward late morning, a rooster called, and the old man's window blushed in a soft wash of rose. He slept, and color drained from the glass, and the east paled ash gray. The rooster called once again, questioningly, and shortly the old man jerked awake in his chair, knocking the jelly glass to the floor where it rolled about woodenly. He peered through the hazy light of the room. It was morning, the lamp out and the stove, too, and he found himself stiff and shivering with the cold, rubbing his eyes now, then his back. He rose gingerly and opened the door of the stove, poked among the feathery ashes. He went to the window and looked out. The snow had stopped. Scout was standing in snow to his belly, gazing out at the fantastic landscape with his bleary eyes. Across the yard, brilliant against the facade of pines beyond, a cardinal shot like a drop of blood. There were three of them coming up the trackless road past the house and two dogs. One of them carried a rabbit, holding it loosely by the hind legs, its head jerking limply as they went. The other two carried guns, and the boy knew one of them. He hadn't seen him since school started in September. They were talking and gesturing, and they didn't notice him standing there in the yard, so he moved out toward the road, making for the mailbox, plopping his feet into the dazzling and unbroken drifts. The one carrying the rabbit had his feet wrapped, wound and encased in burlap sacks to the knee and held with twine. He saw him coming, and then Warren turned and saw him too and waved.
"Hey-o, John Wesley."
"Howdy,"
he said, sliding down the bank. He met Warren Pulliam in the summer, headed toward the pond one afternoon when he saw the buzzard circling low over Tipton's field, and noticed that there was a string looping down from its leg. He came up through the field to the crest of the hill, and there was Warren holding the other end of the string while the buzzard soared with lazy unconcern above his head.
"Howdy," Warren said.
"Howdy."
He was looking up at the buzzard.
"What you doing?" "Oh, just flying the buzzard some. He can't get up less'n they some wind. So when we get a little wind, I generally fly him some."
"Where'd you get him?"
he asked. The back of his neck was already beginning to ache from staring up at the wheeling bird.
"Caught him in a steel trap. You want to see him?"
"Sure."
He pulled the bird out of the sky by main force, heaving on the cord against the huge and ungiving expanse of wing, lowering him circle by circle until he brought him to earth. There the buzzard flopped about on its one good leg and came to rest, eyeing them truculently, beady eyes unblinking and a naked and obscene-looking skull.
Turkey buzzard, Warren explained. They's the ones got red heads. Where do you keep him?
Been keeping him in the smokehouse, he said.
Don't nobody care for you to keep him?
No. The old lady set up a fuss, but I told her I was going to bring him in the house and learn him to set at table, and that calmed her down some. Here, don't get too close or he'll puke on you. He puked on Rock, and Rock liked and never got over it. Stitt won't have nothing to do with him. Don't nobody think much of him, I reckon, but me. I like him because he's about a mean son of a bitch and twice as ugly.
What's your name?
The two dogs were beagles, short-legged and frantic, leaping in and out of the chest-high fall of snow, or plowing their noses through it and furrowing snow up and past their ears, their tails spinning, then looking up with white brows and whiskers, gnomic and hoary-faced as little old men.
Where you all going?
He asked them.
Towards the quarry,
Warren said.
Come on, go with us. I got me a skunk in a hole I got to get out. This here's Johnny Romines,
motioning at the tall boy with the shotgun.
And that there's Boog.
Howdy,
he said. They nodded.
We done got us a rabbit,
Boog said, holding up the snow-dusted and stiffening quarry.
Johnny shot him in the field yonder.
The dogs circled him, sniffing his cuff.
Them's Johnny's dogs, Boog added. Rabbit dogs. Bugles.
Beagles, idiot,
Warren said.
Yeah, Boog said. Them's what they are.
Where's Rock?
The boy asked.
He's laying up under the house still licking his foot where he accidental stepped in the snow this morning. Can't get him to stir a stump. Besides, he won't run rabbits no way. He's a bear dog. I got me a dog now,
he told them.
Half blue tick and half walker. Makes as good a tree dog as they is going.
They were moving up the road, the beagles for outriders, prancing and frisking.
You run him?
Boog asked.
Nah, he's just a pup. I've been keeping him with a feller over on Henderson Valley Road raises dogs. He's the one give him to me. You don't need no more excuse to run wild at night.
That was what she said to him standing there in the kitchen with the pup under his arm.
She must be a pistol,
Silder said when he returned with it, embarrassed, explaining why he couldn't keep it.
Don't make no difference, though. He's Stitt Yorn. You just keep him here is all, and come get him any time you've a mind to. I got me an old musket at home belonged to my great-granddaddy, Boog said. It's nigh on long as me my own self.
They left the road and crossed a field dotted with scrub cedars, the beagles coursing now and Johnny Romines calling to them to hunt. He and Warren trampled the brush piled all down a rock draw and scouted the frozen drainage ditches, but no rabbits appeared. They crossed a fence and came out onto the railroad, following it south across the white-quilted fields, the sun on them now glinting and the last traces of ice fog dispersing in myriad blue crystals on the shining air. At the sinkhole, they stopped and skittered down the bank to test the ice. It was black and evil-looking and woven with sticks and weeds. The beagles came to the edge and whined, pawing tentatively. After a while, they came out too and rushed wheeling and sliding in a game of tag, their hindquarters spinning from under them as they turned. Boog couldn't skate because of his feet being wrapped, so he sat on the bank holding the rabbit and watching them. Later he built a fire, making a platform of hickory bark and piling dead cedar branches on top, and they came and sat around it.
This here's where Johnny caught the bullfrog,
Warren said.
Right over yonder off the end of that log. By the ass, in a mouse trap.
How'd he do that?
John Wesley asked.
He bet me a dope on it. I seen him come by the house with this mousetrap on a piece of baling wire. Said he was fixing to catch him a bullfrog. We come on over and he set it on the end of that log there, and then we went on to the store. I thought the poor bastard had done lost his rabbit-assed mind.
Johnny Romines grinned.
He told everybody in the store,
he said.
Yeah, we all like to have fell out laughing. So the son of a bitch bets me a dope he's caught one by the time we come back, and sure as hell there he is, pinched right by the ass. I like to never got over it. And wouldn't nothing do but we come straight back to the store frog trap and all, and me buy him the dope right there.
It's old Indian trick, said Boog.
What's that?
Putting bark down like that.
To lay your fire on.
When he reached the fence, he rested again, removed his gloves, and blew into his cupped hands. Along the face of the mountain and down the valley floor, guns were sounding, echoing in diminishing reiteration. The trees were all encased in ice, limbless-looking where their black trunks rose in aureoles of lace, bright sea fans shimmering in the wind, and tinkling with an endless bell-like sound, a carillon in miniature, and glittering shards of ice falling in sporadic hail everywhere through the woods, and marking the snow with incomprehensible runes. Something flicked rapid and invisibly past, and struck with a soft pock into the bark of a poplar above him. The thin spat and whine of a rifle followed. The old man paid no attention. He pulled his gloves on, gathered the wire in one hand, and stepped through, the posts on the downhill side jiggling where they dangled in their wires like sticks in a spider web, the earth having long been washed from about their moorings. Some dogs were trailing, and after a while he could see them below him where the last finger of bleak trees reached into a cut and met the barren fields. The dogs coming out from behind the timber, moving slow and diminutive, their voices small as a child's horn, two of them. They dipped into the cut and swarmed up the other side and out, across the fields, their brown and white shapes losing definition in the confectionery landscape of mud clods and snow, until only their motion was discernible, like part of the ground itself rumoring upheaval. He went slowly, the snow heavier now, drifted and billowing in the honeysuckle and breaking it down into the path, so that he had to skirt below it in places, teetering with edged steps along the incline, uncovering in his footsteps wet patches of leaf black as swamp water, not even frozen. When he reached the top of the mountain, the road curving away in a white swath through the trees, he paused to brush the snow from his shoulders and turn out the lumps of ice gathered in his cuffs. He plowed his way down the drift some 100 yards and re-entered the woods to the other side, carrying in his hand now the huge handleless knife forged from an old mill file, receding among the small trees in his stooped and shambling gait, apparitional, a strange Yuletide assassin. A quarter hour later, he emerged back into the road again, still carrying the knife and dragging behind him a small cedar tree. At the curve below the orchard, he stopped and looked back, then relegated the knife to some place in the folds of his coat and shouldered the tree. A little further on, he entered the woods again, trace of a path or road leading off to the right. This time he was gone for only a few minutes. When he came back unburdened of the tree now, he followed his tracks to where he had first come onto the road, and so disappeared once more into the woods, down the slope of the mountain the way by which he came. They threaded their way over the jumbled limestone of the quarry, worn in the lead, until they came to the cave. "It don't look like much," Johnny Romine said. "It opens up inside," Warren said. "Here, let me hang him up here and I'll show you." He wedged the skunk in the fork of a sapling and then disappeared down into the earth, crawling on hands and knees through a small hole beneath the rocks. They followed one by one, the stiff winter nettles at the cave door rattling viperously against the legs of their jeans. Inside they struck matches, and Warren took a candle stub from a crevice and lit it, the calcined rock taking shape, tonsured roof and flowing concavity, like something gone partly to liquid and frozen back again, misshapen and awry, their shadows curling threatfully up the walls among the dried and mounded bat droppings. They studied the inscriptions etched in the soft and curd-colored stone, hearts and names, archaic dates, crudely erotic hieroglyphs, the bulbed phallus and strange centipetal vulva of small boys' imaginations. They followed the strip of red clay that traced the cave floor into another and larger room, hooted at their lapping echoes, their laughter rebounding in hollow and mocking derision. Water dripped ceaselessly, small ping and spatter on stone. The two dogs hung close to them, stepping nervously. "This and here's the biggest room," Warren said. "Then I got me a secret room on back with the rock in front of it so you can't see it. Then there's a tunnel goes back, but I ain't never been to the end of it. Ain't no telling where all it goes." Boog came up dragging a load of dead limbs, and presently they had a fire going in the center of the big room. "This here is the way the cavemen used to do," Boog said. "They used to be cavemen hereabouts," said Warren. "Prehistoric animals, too. There's a tush over on the other side of the mountain sticking out of some rock, what's long as your leg. Ain't no way to get to it lessen you had ropes or something." Johnny Romines took out a packet of tobacco and rolled a cigarette. Boog borrowed it and rolled one, too, and they sat smoking in long, steady pulls. "Which would you rather be?" Boog asked John Wesley. "White or Indian?" "I don't know," the boy said. "White, I reckon. They always whip the Indians." Boog tipped the ash from his cigarette with his little finger. "That's so," he said. "That's a point I hadn't studied." "I got Indian in me," Johnny Romine said. "Boog's half nigger," said Warren. "I ain't done it," Boog said.
You said niggers was good as whites. I never. What I said was some niggers as good as some whites is what I said.
That what you said?
Yeah. I had an uncle was a white cap, Johnny Romine said. You ought to hear him on niggers. He claims they're kin to monkeys.
John Wesley didn't say anything. He'd never met any niggers.
Tell John Wesley here about the time we dynamited the birds, Warren said. This is last Christmas, he explained. His daddy gave him an electric train one time, and they got it out for his little brother.
Johnny Romines told it, slowly, smiling from time to time. They had wired the transformer of the train to a dynamite cap stolen from the quarry shack and buried the cap in the snow.
We had us a long piece of light wire, he said. And we sat in the garage with the transformer all hooked up. Warren here claimed it wouldn't work. Well, we'd sprinkled breadcrumbs all round over where the cap was buried out in the yard, and directly you couldn't see for the birds. I told Warren to throw the switch. Goddamn, but it come an awful blast, said Warren. I eased the switch on over, and then balloon! There's a big hoop of snow jumped up in the yard, like when you throw a flat rock in the pond, and birds going ever which way, mostly straight up. I remember we run out, and you could see pieces of them strung all out in the yard and hanging off the trees. And feathers. God, I never seen the like of feathers. They was stit falling next morning.
Lord, whispered Boog, I'd have liked to have seen that.
John Wesley had begun to cough.
Ain't it getting kindly smoky in here to you? He asked.
Above their heads, smoke roiled and lowered, and they noticed they could no longer see the walls of the cave.
Believe it is some, Warren said.
He stood up and was closed from sight by the smoke.
Hell's bells, he said. Let's get out of here.
This is the way the cavemen done it, Boog said.
Cavemen be damned, we're fixing to get barbecued.
They crawled and stumbled to the mouth of the cave. A shifting patch of murky light weaving beyond the smoke combers came red-eyed and weeping from their crypt, their jacket fronts encrusted with slick red mud. When they had dried their eyes and could see again, they were in some volcanic and infernal under-region. The whole of the quarry woods wrapped in haze and smoke boiling up out of the rocky ground from every cleft and fissure. Mr. Eller stood at the counter and watched them come in, the clothes steaming on the backs of the men as they stomped off the slush from their shoes and stood about the stove making cigarettes with chilled fingers, the stove popping and whistling with the snow-wetted coal, the women excited with the cold, making their purchases with deliberation, some towing small children about in the folds of their skirts, leaving again young boys with shotguns and rifles buying shells not by the box, but by fours and sixes, and lending to the bustle a purposeful and even militant air. He rang the money up in the cash register or marked it in his credit books. Odor of smoke and cold, wet clothing and meat cooking. The snow was falling again and they watched it.
Lord, Mr. Eller said, reckon it's ever going to quit?
Boog and Johnny Romines came in with a rabbit and they each got a dope.
Where about you get him, Johnny?
Mr. Eller asked.
Over on the crick. Warren Pulliam caught a skunk in a hole, Boog said.
That right. How's he smell?
He don't smell too purty.
The men laughed.
He's a fat un,
one said, nodding toward the rabbit.
How's them pups run? Pretty good? Pretty good little old rabbit dogs, Johnny said. They jumped two more, but I never got a clear shot.
Them's beagles, said Boog.
The old man came out on the Pike Road at the gap where the Greenfly Inn had stood. There was no trace of the inn now but the black and limbless pine trunk that stood in the hollow. Snow had started again, dropping like a veil over the valley or riding the wind through the gap, stinging his face a little. He walked down until he came to the Twin Fork Road and took it into the hopper and homeward. From a light wire overhead, dangling head downward and hollowed to the weight of ashened feathers and fluted bones, a small owl hung in an attitude of forlorn exhortation, its wizened talons locked about the single strand of wire. It stared down from the dark and empty sockets, penduluming softly in the bitter wind. At the head of the hollow there was a spring house, and they stopped to drink, the water green and pulsing up from the rocks where a scalloped fringe of ice jutted just above the waterline.
I figured to set here, Warren said, but there's too many people come by and you'd get your trap stole. Come on, I'll show you where I got my culvert set.
He dipped up another mouthful of the numbing water, took the rifle and trap, and handed the skunk to the younger boy.
He don't smell so bad out in the air, he said. The old lady'll pitch a hissy when she gets a whiff of me, though.
They came out on the road and crossed to the other side where the creek ran. Warren got down on one knee and peered back through the culvert under the road where the spring run trickled through.
"It don't never freeze in here," he said. "I done caught me one muskrat here, but what I'm looking for is a mink. See? I got the trap just back inside where nobody won't notice it."
The boy peered into the dark tunnel, the water loping slowly down the corrugated metal and flaring where it passed over the trap.
"I seen mink sign here back in the fall and some lately," Warren said. "They's mink on Stock Creek, too. Used to be some on Red Branch, but they ain't anymore is how come I don't trap it no more. Are you ready to go?"
"See, they ain't been no cars in here yet," Warren said. "Ain't but just a few people live over here in the holler, and mostly they ain't got cars. You see that house up yander?"
He looked where Warren pointed. Set back off the road was a squat, saddle-roofed structure with a thin wisp of smoke swirling and circling about the top of the chimney.
"That's where Garland Hobie lives," he told him. "You mess around there, you get your ass shot off."
"How come?"
"On account of he makes whiskey," Warren said. "Him and his old lady. Here, I'll show you something directly."
Beyond the curve of the road, there was an old frame church, and Warren pointed it out.
"See that church? Well, that was a nigger church. They used to be a bunch of niggers lived in the holler, and they built this here church and commenced singing and hollering of a night. Till old man Hobie, he's dead now. He run them every one off. He's been dead since afore you and me was born, and they ain't none of them come back yet. That's how strong he was on niggers. They say F was even meaner'n the old man. He died right at the store back a few year ago. Just got out of Brushy Mountain. Garland, he's meaner'n hell, too. They raided him one time here back, and he give him the old lady to take off to jail. His own mama. That's how bad he is. Then there's Uncle Ather, lives up here, nodding ahead of him. He's a pretty good old feller."
"Is he your uncle?"
"No. Him and Granddaddy Pulliam worked together cutting sleepers for the KS&E. So the old man always called him uncle. He's pretty old. Got a dog pretty near old as you and me both."
"That's pretty old," the boy said.
"How old is he, Uncle? Uncle Ather? He must be 90 or better. He's older than Granddaddy Pulliam, and Granddaddy Pulliam's daddy fought in the Civil War. He owned a lot of land in Knox County, and when the war was over, they took it away from him on account of him being a Confederate. Granddaddy Pulliam says they wouldn't even let nobody vote, except in niggers and Yankees."
"Why was that?"
"On account of back then, this was the North, I reckon."
Late in the afternoon, the old man was sweeping the snow from his front porch when he saw them coming up the road. Two small figures, dark against the unbroken fall of snow, laboring through the drifts. One of them was carrying a dead skunk. They came abreast of his mailbox, and the taller one raised his hand.
"Hey-o, Uncle Ather," he called.
The old man squinted his milk-blue eyes against the glare.
Hiram Pulliam's grandson.
He grinned and waved them up, and they came, toiling on the slope, bow-legged, for a better grip in the snow, the Pulliam boy leaning on his rifle and the other one sliding and waving the skunk about in the air. They sat around the stove with their shoes off, their socks steaming. The old man wrinkled his nose and laughed.
"I believe you must have fit that there polecat hand to hand," he said.
"Can you smell it?"
Warren said.
"I can't smell it myself. He had to crawl back in a hole to get him out," John Wesley said. "I crawled past where he was at," Warren said. "I thought he was on his way back, and then I come to see the wire, and it went off into a little side hole, but I was already past it then. I was all hunkered up down in there and couldn't hardly turn around. But directly I got to where I could poke my pine knot in the side hole there, and I seen his eyes. I got my rifle turned around and aimed the best way I could, and when I shot, it liked to bust it out my eardrums. We could hear him shoot," John Wesley said. "It sounded like a little old popgun or something from on the outside. Well, when I shot, he cut loose, too. I mean, it really steamed things up in there. I come scooting out hind end first, and we waited a while. And then directly I went back and got hold of the wire and come dragging him out, and he shot between the eyes."
The old man laughed.
"That puts me in mind of a coon hunt I was on one time," he said. "Feller with us shot a coon in a tree, and it hung in a limb. So I helped the light, and he went up after him. Time he got to the limb where the coon was at, it come to life and made at him. He figured pretty quick he didn't want no part of it, but instead of coming down, he scooted up another limb, and there he set. Every time he made like he was coming down, the coon'd go at him, growling like a bear. Well, directly he got mad, and he decided he'd come on down anyway. So here he come. He was going to kick the coon off of the limb, is what he hollered down to us. We had the lantern on him and could see pretty good. He He made two or three swipes at the coon, and about that time the old coon latched onto his foot. I never heard the like of hollering. He commenced swinging that coon around on the end of his toe, and he got so took up with it, he kindly eased up his holt on the tree. Well, wasn't but a few minutes one of us hollered to look out, and here they come piling down out of the tree. He hit the ground like a sack of feet and just laid there, and the dogs piled on to the coon, and they commenced walking all in his face and fighting till we got him kicked off. We thought he's dead, but directly he begun to breathe a little and his eyes to flitter some, and we seen he wasn't hurt, just the wind pooched out of him and scared pretty bad. We all laughed considerable, and he sat there and cussed us, but he was a pretty good old boy, and I reckon he never held it against us. I remember he used to tell it on his own self for years and years and laugh just like anybody. The old man sighed. Used to be good coon hunting hereabouts, he said. What about painters? Warren asked. Was that a painter was hollering around here one time? The old man leaned back in his rocker, a wise grin settling among his sagging skin folds. Well, now, he said. Sure, I remember that right well. Been about 10 years ago, I'd say. There followed a moment of silence in which he seemed to be contemplating with satiric pleasure some old deed. Then he crossed one knee over the other and leaned forward. Sure, he repeated. I heard it. Many's the time. Had folks stirred up and scared all of one summer. Yes, sir, stirred up a blue fog of speculating. What did it sound like? The boy asked. Oh, pretty fierce. Well, you reckon it was a painter? Nope, the old man said. After a minute, Warren said, What was it? The old man had begun to rock gently, a benign look upon his face, composed in wisdom. Old Hierophant savoring a favorite truth. He stopped and looked down at them. Well, I'll tell you. It was a hoot owl. He studied their fallen faces, the hopeful incredulity. Yep, he said, a hoot owl. One of them big uns, screeching and a-hollering on this mountain of summer evenings like any painter. These folks said painter, folks said not. But I knowed what it was right along. So I let them do their speculating and arguing. I recollect one evening I was at the store getting some things, late summer it was, and nigh dark, about 8 o'clock, I reckon, when it commenced hollering. Well, I never said nothing. In a little bit it come again. Boys, I mean it got quiet in that store to where you could hear the ants in the candy jar. Instead, I never let on nothing, and after a while Bob Kirby, he's there, he hollered at me and he said, Hey, Uncle Ather, you fixin' to walk across that mountain tonight? Well, I turned to him kind of surprised-like and I said, Why, sure. A feller's got to get home sometime and the best way he can. How come you to ask me that? He just looked at me for a minute. Then he kind of grinned and he said, Can't you hear that wampus cat? Why, I said, Sure I hear it. Anybody that wasn't deaf could hear that, I reckon. Well, he kind of figured he had me then, so he says, Ain't you scared of painters, Uncle Ather? Why, sure, I says. Anybody excepting a fool'd be scared of one, a full-growed one, leastways. Then I never said nothing, just went to the dope box and got me a dope and commenced drinking it and looking at my watch every once in a while. I could see he was plenty puzzled, and he tried to slip a grin to the rest of the fellers there once or twice, except they wasn't grinning, and I reckon was more puzzleder than he was. So he never said nothing, neither. But after a while, there's a young feller there. He piped up and asked me if that wasn't a full-growed one that was raising all that hell out there. Well, about that time it come again, hollering. And I looked at him and I said, Hey, Lord God, son, I don't know what you'd do if a growed one was to squall. Why, that ain't nothing there. But then, of course, they ain't painters round like they used to be. Back 50, 60 years ago, they'd sing out back and forth across these mountains all night of a summer, till you got to where you couldn't sleep less than you did hear 'em. But it takes a big old Tom painter to set up a fuss. That there ain't nothing. I told him that, and about that time, sure enough, that owl let out another screech. Couldn't have been 100 yards off. And I could see the hackles come up on his neck, and on Bob Kirby's, too. I finished my dope and set it down and made like I was fixing to leave then. And Kirby, he says, stit grinning kind of, You mean, Uncle Ather, that you can tell one painter from another and by its squall? Well, I said, I don't reckon I can so good anymore. He grinned right big at that. But I says, since I seen this and t'other night, I guess it just don't worry me none. Well, they all jumped up with something to ask then, how big it was and all. I was already half out the door, but I figured to give them something to think about while they walked home. So I turned to them and I says, "Why, it ain't more'n a kitten. It's right up here in the gap, not even dusk dark t'other night I seen it scoot across the road." Old Scout was laying there on the concrete. Now, he's fell off some of late, but used to be he come a good bit higher'n my knee, to where you just could straddle him, and weighed better'n 100 pound. So I looked around, and I seen him there, and I just pointed to him, and I said, "Why, he ain't a whole lot bigger'n Scout here," and said him a good night and went on.
Down the small panes of glass behind the old man's chair, the sun lowered, casting his head in silhouette and illumining his white hair with a prophetic translucence. A little later he rose and went to the table and lit the lamp.
"You boys care for some? Here, just a minute."
He excused himself and went flapping off to the kitchen, from where issued in a moment sounds of cupboards and glassware. When he came back, he was carrying 2 glasses and a cup, a mason jar of some dark red liquid. "Here," he said, handing them each a glass. He unscrewed the lid of the jar and poured their glasses. A heavy and evil-looking potion the color of iodine.
"Muscadine wine," he said. "Bet you all ain't never had none."
It beaded black and sinister in the soft lamp glow. He settled himself in his rocker and filled his cup, watching them taste it.
"Mighty fine," Warren said.
"Yes, sir," said the boy.
They sipped their wine with the solemnity of communicants, troglodytes gathered in some firelit cave. The lamp guttered in a draft of wind, and their shadows, ponderous and bear-like upon the wall, weaved in unison.
"Uncle Ather," said the boy, "was they really painters back then?"
Warren's face, a harlequin mask etched in black and orange by the lamplight, turned to the old man.
"Tell him about bettin', Uncle Ather," he said. "Bettin' you had."
Uncle Ather had already started.
"Oh, yes,"
he said, allaying doubt with an upthrust of his chin.
"Yes, they was, long time back. When I was a young feller, working on the road crew at that time, I caught one."
"Caught one?"
"Yep."
He smiled mysteriously.
"Sure did. Caught him with my bare hands, and I got the scars to prove it."
Here he extended a leathery thumb for inspection. The boy slid from his chair and bent studiously over it.
"Right here,"
the old man said, pointing to a place on the inside just above the web.
"See?"
"Yes," he said. The skin was wrinkled like an old purse. In that myriad cross-hatching, any line could have been a scar. He sat back down, and the old man chuckled throatily.
"Yes, sir,"
he said.
"He was a vicious critter. Must have weighed all of 5 pound.
Warren laughed softly. The boy raised his head. The old man sat complacent and mischievous in his rocker, his eyes dancing.
"Well," he said, "this is what happened. There was a place called Goose Gap. It's up towards Ware's Valley. Well, it was when we was blasting in there. Bill Monroe, he's dead now. He went up right after, soon as rock quit falling, and then he hollered for me to come up and look see. They stit lots of smoke and dust, and I couldn't see too good, but I got on up a little ways, and directly I seen he's holding up something. Looked like a groundhog or a little old dog. When I got to where he was at, I seen what it was. I had never seen one afore, and it was all tore up and bloody, but I knowed right off what it was. Bill, he couldn't make nothing out of it. What it was a painter kit. We started up through them rocks, and directly we come up on another. It wasn't tore up as bad, and Bill allowed as to how it must not have been blowed as fur, and so we was headed right. Anyway, it turned out he was right, and in a little bit we come up on the den hole. It was all blowed out in the front, and about a yard and a half of bones laying all around. And back in the back, under some rocks, we found this'n, the third'n. He's alive and mewling just about like a house cat. Old Bill, he backed off some. Said that old she-painter might be around. Well, I was younger than him and likely didn't have as good sense. So in I goes and grabs the little feller up by the scruff of the neck. That's when he hung his tushes in my thumb here. I turned loose right fast, I'll tell you. Well, I figured a minute, and then I took off my shirt and scotched him up in that and brought him on home with me."
Here the old man paused and helped himself to a chew of tobacco from a huge paper pouch.
"I lived 5 mile this side of Sevierville then," he continued. "You boys don't chew, do you?"
"No."
"I had bought me a place off a man named Delosier. 20 acres, mostly side hill, and not much of a house, neither, an old piece of a barn. I was married then, and that was my first place, so I reckon I was kindly what you might say proud of it. I kept some hogs and chickens, and later on I had me a cow and a wore-out mule. Put me in some corn. I never had nothing, ain't got nothing now, but I figured it was a start. I wasn't a whole lot older than you fellers. 19, I think I was. But anyway, what I was fixin' to tell was about that painter. I brought him on home and give him to Ellen. She took to it right off, kept it in a box and give it milk and such as that. It got to where it'd folly her around the house like a everyday walking around cat. It wasn't but about the size of a cat, too. I recollect he's speckled kindly like a bobcat. Well, there's even a feller come out from the newspaper and wrote it up about us having him. Folks come from pretty near everywhere to see him. I reckon it was about 2 weeks we'd had him when one evening I heard one of the hogs squeal. I got the lantern and went out, but I couldn't find nothing wrong, and went on back in and never thought no more about it. Well, next morning there's a hog gone. I hadn't ever heard of nobody stealing hogs, but I figured maybe they's hog thieves just like every other kind, up in Sevier County leastwise, as that was pretty woolly country at that time. But there wasn't a whole lot I could do about it, not knowing where to even start looking. Then 2 nights later, another of them went. Well, I says, they're getting slicker now. The second one never even squealed. Next night I laid up on the roof of the house with the shotgun, a old single-barrel muzzle loader, and me with not enough money to buy caps with, even. I was using match heads and cottonseed hulls. And here's somebody stealing my hogs. So I laid up there all night, no further than from here to the porch yonder from that hog pen. I never seed nothing nor heard nothing. Come morning, I never even looked at the hogs, even. Then when she, Ellen, went out later on and slopped them, she come back in and she says, "Ather, there's another hog gone." I was sitting in a chair about half asleep, and I come from there. I don't recollect how many hogs it was we had, but 7 or 8, I reckon, anyway. And I run out and counted them and come up short one more hog. I'd been mad afore, but now I was scared. Here the old man found the cup of wine in his hand, and he regarded it for a moment with mild surprise, raised it, and took a drink. He closed his eyes for a moment. The high wagon and them coming up to the house, wagon and house both belonging to his uncle, and him owning nothing more than he could carry in his 2 hands, her things in an old leather trunk tied down behind the seat. "That her?" he asked. "Yes, sir." He walked around the wagon slowly, studying her as a man might a horse. Then he said, "Well, Light." He got down and she was still sitting there. "What's she? Going to put the mule up?" "No, sir," he said. "Ellen, here." He took her hand and she got down. "You go on with Uncle Whitney," he said. "I'll get the things." "Helen," he said. "It's Ellen," she said. The wagon moved away behind her. "Ellen." "Daddy said he'd kill him," she said. "Ain't nobody going to kill nobody," he said. "Here, watch the mud." She said something else. He watched them go in. "What happened then, Uncle Ather?" one said. "Hmm? Oh, well, I done lost 3 of them, I think it was, then. That was 3 more than I was willing to lose, and 2 more than I thought I would lose without I caught somebody. Aside that it looked like I would lose just as many as whoever I was losing them to was willing to take, which probably meant all of them. So I was mad scared. Ellen, she claimed I had gone to sleep on the roof, but I knowed better. That was late of a summer. I was stid on the road crew and working 12 and 14 hours a day, and here I got to come home nights and set up with a bunch of hogs. But we never lost no more for a week or better. Then one night Ellen went to the door to throw out a pan of water, and I heard her holler. I run out, and she grabbed onto me like she'd seen a hat or something. And I asked her what it was. But she just stood there and shook like she's freezing to death. I walked her back in and went out and looked, but I never seen nothing. So I got the pan and come on in. Something had scared her real bad, but she couldn't tell me what all it was. After a while, all she'd say was, "I don't know," or "I couldn't tell what it was." The old man paused again, arrested but for the rise and fall of his breathing, the slow mechanical rotation of his jaws, gazed upward. The image of the lamp flame on the ceiling, the split corona a doubling egg, like the parthenogenesis of primal light,
He kept on for a week, coming back each night to the dark and empty house. Then he stopped going to work. That morning he took out the few things she had left, a house coat, odds and ends, and put them on the bed. He sat and looked at them for a long time. When he got up, it was evening. He stayed for 5 more days, wandering about the house or sitting motionless, sleeping in chairs, eating whatever he happened to find until there wasn't any more, and then not eating anything. While the chickens grew thin and the stock screamed for water, while the hogs perished to the last shoat, an outrageous stench settled over everything, a vile decay that hung in the air filled the house. On the 6th day, he went out and knocked a plank from the back of the barn with the pole of his axe, cut from it 2 boards. On one, he carefully incised her name with the point of his knife. Then he chopped a stake point on the other board and nailed the 2 together in the form of a cross. He took it and took her clothes and a spade down to a corner of the lot where he scooped a hole, buried the clothes, and with the shank of the spade pounded the cross into the ground. Then he walked straight through the house and out again, across the yard, to the road and toward Sevierville. He had gone 0.5 mile before he noticed the shovel in his hand and pitched it into the weeds. "I know you can't," he said. "I ain't going back. I'll go out tomorrow. Come on, you clean up and eat some."
"What?"
"And get some rest, sleep. I'll go out tomorrow."
"Well, you can. I ain't.
I was going out anyways. R.L. come by yesterday morning to see if you was coming back."
"You going back?"
"I don't know. No. I ain't going back."
"You aim to sell your place?"
"It don't... I don't care."
"Well, I do."
He looked at him for the first time, the older face, dark and hard as a walnut.
"Why?"
he asked.
"'Count of you owe me $200, mainly."
"Oh." He thought for a minute, then he said, "Yes, here, I got to clean up." The old man was swaying slowly in his rocker, holding the cup before him in both hands like a ciborium. After a minute, Warren said,
"Did you ever find out what it was?"
The old man turned and spat into a coffee can.
"That goddamned Bible drummer, wasn't it?"
"Don't say nothing else."
"Well, nobody never died from it."
"Don't say nothing else, I told you."
"Yes, sir," he said. "It was the old she painter come after the little one. You boys care for some more wine?"
They still had some. The old man labored up from his rocker and went to the table where he had set the wine, refilled his cup.
"Yep," he said. "That had to have been what she seen."
"Did you shoot it?" the boy asked.
"Nope. Never even seen her. I lost one more hog and then I give it up. I turned the little one loose and that's the last I ever seen of it and the last hog I lost."
"You see," he said, slowly, darkly,
"they's painters and they's painters. Some of them is just that, and then others is right uncommon. That old she-painter, she never left a track one. She wasn't no common kind of painter."
Early next morning, the old man worked his way up the mountain, following the prints of the 2 boys. The snow was drifted deeply in places, and it was hard going. He stopped often to catch his breath, leaning on the shotgun, the stock sunk cleanly through the crust to the depth of the trigger guard. By the time he reached the road, he was winded and leg-weary. From here, he could see out into the valley, through the stark trees standing blackly in an ether of white like diffused milk, glazed and crystalline as shattered ice where the sun probed, the roofs thatched with snow, pale tendrils of smoke standing grayly in the still air. He could smell smoke, but he didn't think about it until it occurred to him that it had a sharp and pungent quality about it, and he realized that it was cedar burning, postwood, not firewood, elusive in the cold air, in his nostrils, faintly antiseptic. He turned up the road and walked steadily until he came to the cutoff to the pit. The snow was dry and powdered as marble dust on his trouser legs. Now he could see the faint pall of smoke through the trees. The tracks turned here and furrowed in 2 drunken lanes, curving into the woods. He followed them, moving faster, stumbling in and out of the snow ruts, shadowed by some presentiment of ruin, into the clearing. When he saw the smoke rolling up from out of the pit, he stopped for a moment and he could feel the old fierce pull of blood in power and despair, the pulse drum of the irrevocable act. And it was done. What soul rose in the ashes forever unknown, out of his hands now. He squatted on one knee in the snow watching. On his face, a suggestion of joy, of anguish, something primitive and half-hidden. The pale eyes burned cold and remote in their hollows like pockets of smoldering gas. He rose and retraced his steps back to the road. In the pit, the amber coals glowed molten in their bed beneath the charred skeletons of the cedars.
Because the car was pulled over up the road and I couldn't see it from the crick, and he wasn't on the bridge when I come down, but after I waded through and come out the other side, he was standing on it looking down at me, and I seen him then and he said, "Come here."
"So he took your traps?"
"All of them except in one," the boy said. "He'd have had to have waited to find it, so I never told him about it. He took the three of them. I didn't have but four."
"Low-life son of a bitch," Silder said.
"What did you tell him?"
"I never told him nothing. He said he was going to take me to jail for trapping without license and betting criminals. I told him I didn't know nothing about some criminals."
"Legwater, what did he say?"
"Not much. Just sort of grinned like a possum. Yeah, he said it'd go a lot easier on me if I was to tell him about it. That it was the same thing, betting a criminal, as being one your own self. Then Gifford said that was right, how I'd likely get 3 to 5 years, but that if I'd help him out and tell who it was, I might get off with just a suspended sentence."
"But they didn't take you in?"
"No. He turned me loose at the Forks, the store. He said soon as they got the rest of the evidence, they'd pick me up, and how it wouldn't do me no good to try to run."
He sat back in the chair, finished now, and waiting to know what to do, just beginning to be not so scared. Silder leaned toward him.
"Listen," he said, "you know that's all horseshit, don't you? You know what an ass it'd make him look to come dragging a 14-year-old boy in, even for helping a runner, let alone trapping without license? He's just trying to scare you. I know him. He can't prove no way in the world you helped me. And if they caught me, it'd have to be with the load, in which case they wouldn't need nobody's testifying, let alone yours. And even if they did, I'd swear I never seen you before in my life. And you do the same thing, so they still couldn't bother you. It's all horse shit, trying to bluff and scare you into helping him poke his nose where it don't belong. He bothers you again, you tell him nothing. Tell him you'll get him for false arrest. Except I don't think he's going to bother you no more. He said he'd catch you anyway." "He couldn't catch cow shit in a wash tub. It ain't even his business. He ain't the ATU. Anyway, don't you let him bother you. I'll tend his apples for him my own self. He knowed you didn't have no daddy, nobody to take up for you in the first place is the reason he figured he could jump on you. He's a low-life son of a bitch and a cared to boot. Here, come take a look at your pup. He's fat as a butterball. Come on, I got him on the back porch on account of it being so cold."
The pike had been cleared for some time in the afternoon so that he didn't even need the chains after he came off the orchard road. Dark now, something after 6 o'clock. The rear end of the car heavy and swaying low over the wheels, even with the Lovejoy set up as far as they would go. It was very cold, and his toes had not yet thawed under the gas heater. He thought how the stump of a toe in his left boot was particularly sensitive, remembering again the sweep of the cutter's lights on the stanchions of the bridge, the glazed and blinding eye of the spotlight when it picked him out, standing on the forward deck under a canopy of mangrove, with his foot braced on the cleat and holding the anchor rope. When the light caught him, he yelled once down into the cabin and began hauling in on the rope. The starter whirred, and the motor coughed gutturally at the water, the boat jostling, already moving. He got the anchor in and watched the cutter lights. Even above the high weaning of their own motor, he could hear her revving the big double gray engines as she swung about, then voices, commands, detached and sourceless on the steamy calm of the Gulf. The cutter spot followed them, swamping them in light as they came out of the backwater. He might have been a ballerina pirouetting there. He could see the twin spume flaring from the prow of the cutter, rising as she took speed, and the running lights bobbing and bobbing again in the black wash of the cutwater. He heard the shots, too, quite clearly, but made no association between them and himself. It didn't occur to him that he was being shot at until a real flurry broke out, and he could see the muzzle flashes, minute and intermittent, like cigarettes glowing, and hear the pebbly thoop-thoop of the bullets in the passing water. Then he jumped and started for the cabin. Instantly, there came the sounds of splintering wood, and then something tore at his foot and threw him to the deck. He crawled to the companionway and slid down it on his belly.
"Jimmy!"
he called, a hoarse whisper as if someone might hear them.
Oh, Jimmy!
It was dark in the compartment except for the skittering glow of the searchlight passing and repassing the portholes, the portholes in bright silhouette wandering back and forth on the far wall.
Hey, kid, what you say?
Jimenez standing in the passageway. The tiller momentarily abandoned, the craft tilting full throttle across the water, the pulsing slap-slap of it under the keel.
I'm shot,
he said. Jimenez holding the flashlight while he removed the shredded shoe. The sock sticky with blood examined the pulpy mess of his big toe.
Where else, Mario? I reckon that's it, he said.
Jimmy patting his shoulder commiseratingly.
It's hard on the feet, that, he said.
They went forward and he wrapped his toe in a strip torn from his shirt and sat there miserably, watching Jimenez's face green and serious in the glow of the panel lights. He drove slowly, coming through the gap with the moon riding low over the pines that edged the long and barren slash of white beneath the power line, ice fog coming up from the hollow, scintillant in the lights. Here where the inn stood, the carnival atmosphere with a few cars strung alongside the road, the heat flickering over them and the men standing about passing the last of the bottles back and forth, talking quietly now, their faces flushed and convivial. Some late arrivals claimed the blaze to have been visible from Vestal. Someone saying,
You done missed it, Marion.
Was it a good'un?
Best you ever seen.
Nothing to be done there. A drink of whiskey, sneaking it now, Gifford having arrived. Gifford with a long pole, poking steaming holes in the melt of glass. Gloop, gloop. Vitreous tar.
Damnedest thing I ever seen.
One Brogantau began to blister and blacken, and a moment later he was hopping away, snatching at his shoelaces.
Goddamn! Whew!
Leaning against a tree, with his naked foot cradled in his hands like a hurt bird, he dared a snicker with fierce eyes. And 2 days later, the charred shaft of the pine tree still smoldering, pitch bubbling gently from the shell of the bark and small electric blue flames seeping and curling, the spire of smoke standing straight up in the motionless air like a continuation of the tree itself. On the curve below the gap, the rear wheels drifted slightly, and he realized that there was a thin sheet of ice on the road. He sat up over the wheel and wiped the glass with a rag. He passed Tipton's, the lights above the road warm and friendly looking through the trees. Old married men. Silder chuckled, reached for his cigarettes.
He was the nicest boy.
The rain peening steadily the tin roof of the church, obelisks of light slanting down from the high windows like buttresses. After the creak of the door, nothing but the huge breathing silence, musty odor, the patient and quiet abandonment, chairs, benches, the pulpit. All orderly and still in their coats of dust, an air of mild surprise about them at this late visitation. Their steps ghostly on the warping boards, rousing an owl from the beams, passing over them on soundless wings, a shadow ascending into the belfry like an ash sucked up a flue and a silently. She gripped his arm. Together to the mourner's bench.
Oh, Lord, oh, Lord.
Witnessed by one nightbird. Topping the hill above the creek, he came upon a half-ton truck with a horse on it, the long, bland face peering down at him over the slatted tailgate with eyes luminous and round as bottle bottoms in the car lights. The truck was laboring at the hill with beetle-like industry, the gears grinding out a low whine. He watched the snow swirling over the road behind it, serpentine, white wisps like smoke on glass, eased up on the shift lever and passed them, the horse's off-eye rolling wildly, past the cab, the driver dimly lit within, puffing at a cigar, looking down at him once.
One side for the hooch man, Silder said. New Year's whiskey coming. Figure 10 headaches to the gallon makes 1,000, about 1,200 real hat stretchers. How about that, old man?
Old man puffed his cigar, receding rearward, dimmed his lights to one dull orange globe. He drove straight down Gay Street, halting obediently at the stoplights, gazing at the numbed traffic officers with insolent bemusement.
Howdy, blue boy. Care for a drink?
Out on the west side of town, he pulled into a drive and around behind an aged and ill-kept frame house. He backed the coupe up to the garage and got out, stretching a little. Two men came from the house, the kitchen, where a small window was lit. Another man came to the door and stood there leaning against the jamb, his shirt tail out, smoking a cigarette and taking the air. A woman's voice, small and shrill, somewhere in the house behind him.
Shut the door, idiot. You raised in a barn?
He didn't move.
Howdy, Silder.
the first man said, going past him to the garage, not even looking at him.
Howdy,
Silder said. The other one stopped.
How's the new car? He asked.
All right. Ward says it come out of Cosby.
Could be.
Ward says it's plenty fast. Says they blockaded the feller on the Newport highways, the only way they ever come to catch him at all.
Let's go.
Tiny, the other man, called from the garage. Silder went to the rear of the coupe and opened the deck lid. They began to unload, carrying the cases back into the garage, the car creaking and rising bit by bit, until they had finished and it stood with its rear end high in the air like a cat in heat. Silder took a flashlight and wrench from the glove compartment, stooped by the rear wheels, each in turn, and lowered the car. Then he undid the chains, got in, and drove off them. Came back and put them in the trunk. The motor was still running, and as he slid behind the wheel once more, Tiny came to lean on the door.
Don't she sound sweet, though, he said.
Silder looked up at him.
That what Ward says?
Tiny grinned.
Nah, he said. Seems to me that's what McCrary said. When Ward loaned him the money to buy it. Tell Ward good cars costs good money, even at a government auction. Or even if you done paid for them once.
He set the gears and ran the motor up once, and Tiny stood up.
Come back, he said.
Silder was rolling up the glass.
We'll see you,
he said, switched on the headlights, and pulled away down the drive. He drove slowly back to the mountain, past the forks and the store, the porch posts dead white as plaster casts of those untrimmed poles, the huge carved lion's head in fierce cameo upon the door, the brass knocker brightly pendant from its nostrils, and the barred panes buckling in the light, plainless as falling water, passing out of the glare in willowing sheets to darkness, stark and stable once again. Past his own house, dark but for the light on the porch, and then across the mountain, still slowly, pulling the grades down under the wheels easily. The road was glazed with ice on the far side, and he amused himself by drifting the coupe from curve to curve like a boat tacking. At the foot of the mountain, he left Henderson Valley Road and turned right down Bays Mountain Road, driving on gravel now, slowing to some 10 or 15 miles an hour, and finally switching off the headlights. He drove that way for half a mile, the coupe rolling ghostly over the road, black and silent against the snow. Then he turned the car around in a drive, pointing it back down the road and got out. He walked up the road until he came to the next drive, and here he turned in, plodding through the snow to the lightless house where it brooded in a copse of trees, solitary above the empty fields, over and around it the naked branches tangled like ironwork. He walked around the house twice. No dogs barked. At the back again, he tested a window, lifted it, the weights slithering in the sashes, stepped through and inside. He found himself in an areaway off the kitchen, two doors in front of him, one leading to a large open room, the other one closed.
Hola, Jeffo,
he called, whispered in mock and inaudible greeting.
Dorme?
On down-pointed cat's feet, he stepped the three steps to the closed door and folded his hand over the knob.
Oh, Jeffo,
he whispered.
Es muy malo que no tengas un perro.
Turned the knob and opened the door. There was one small high window in the room, a square of gray standing out of the blackness. And other than that, he could see nothing. He stood at the door for a few minutes, listening to the rumbling breath of the man asleep. After a while, he could make out the shape of the bed directly in front of him. It was warm in the room. He could feel the sweat in his armpits. But the man was swathed heavily in blankets. Thickness of them under his hand. Here, shape of arm, of shoulder, chest. Sleeping on his back. Gifford snuffled. One gluey eyelid came unstuck as the covers receded from his chin with maternal solicitude. He even raised his head a little, wonderingly, sleep leaving him in slow, grudging waves, so that he seemed to be coming up to meet it, the shut fist rocketing down out of blackness and into his face with a pulpy sound like a thrown melon bursting. When he got home, it was past midnight and had turned off colder yet. He parked the coupe at the back of the house, scotched the wheel, and went in through the kitchen. He took some biscuits and a jar of preserves from the icebox and ate them, walking up and down a little, flexing his knuckles. When he had finished, he put the preserves back, took a long drink from a jar of buttermilk, and then went into the bedroom. His right hand was swollen, and he picked delicately at the buttons of his coat.
Marion?
Yeah, he said.
Oh, what time is it?
Late, I reckon. I got tied up.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
He stepped out of his trousers and crawled in beside her. She could feel him laughing silently.
What?
She said.
He kept asking who it was. What? Who did? Hmm?
No, nothing. Just some feller. Go on to sleep.
She turned over and put her hand on his chest. She said,
Hush.
He lay on his back, his hand over hers, the other hand stiffening. Suddenly he had a bile-sharp foretaste of disaster. Why was that old man shooting holes in a government tank on the mountain?
You sure have got cold feet, she said.
He stared up at the dark ceiling.
I'll be damned if I do,
he whispered to himself.